I'm Chris Kresser, and this is Revolution Health Radio. Hey everybody, it's Chris Kresser. Welcome to another episode of Revolution Health Radio. This week we've got a question from Tyler.
Hey everyone, if you're like most people I know, you don't have the time or the desire or training for that matter to sift through the hundreds of medical studies that are published each month. But whether you're struggling with a chronic health problem or just want to maintain your health and live as long as possible, it's important to stay informed about the latest research and how it might affect your well-being. And let's face it, it's easy to get overwhelmed by all the conflicting stories in the media. You need a source of unbiased information that you can rely on, one that's easy to understand without too much jargon and full of practical tips that you can put into action. That's where my website, chriskresser.com, comes in. You'll find in-depth, evidence-based articles on a wide range of health and nutrition topics each week. You'll also find over 10 free ebooks on subjects like effortless weight loss, healing your gut, thyroid disorders, and natural skin care, as well as online classes and programs on optimizing nutrition for fertility and pregnancy and lowering your cholesterol without drugs. What you won't find is any third-party advertising, corporate influence, or hype-driven, headline-grabbing stories with a lot of drama but no substance. You just get the real inside scoop on the health issues that matter to you most. So head over to chriskresser.com and check it out. And when you sign up for my email newsletter, you'll get instant access to my award-winning 63-page ebook, 9 Steps to Perfect Health. It's like an instruction manual for preventing and reversing disease and living a long and healthy life. Okay, now back to the show.
Hey, Chris, really enjoy the podcast. I've been listening and interested in a paleo diet ever since I heard you on the Joe Rogan Experience podcast last year. I'm somebody who takes statin medication for familial hypercholesterolemia. I wondered if you thought a paleo diet would still work for somebody like me who's on that statin medication, and just wanted to get your thoughts on that. Thank you.
Thanks for sending in your question, Tyler. It's a great one, but unfortunately, it's difficult to answer in a short time. You know, in the conventional paradigm, this is a really black and white or binary issue. You have total cholesterol and LDL cholesterol that are tested regularly, and if they're high, then the doctor will typically prescribe a statin, and the patient's instructed to take it for the rest of his or her life, and that's the end of the story. But the reality is actually far more complex. And we could do several podcasts on this topic. In fact, we could probably just dedicate a podcast to it and keep doing it over and over again because there's so much information to cover and there's so much new research that comes out that, you know, changes the landscape. You know, 4 out of 10 people that die each year die of a heart attack. And so this is obviously a really big problem and one that doesn't lend itself well to a pat answer on a 20-minute podcast. I've written a lot about this. In fact, I got my start in this field writing about the relationship between cholesterol and lipids and heart disease over 10 years ago now. And so some of the earliest writings that I did were on this topic. More recently, I wrote an entire updated series on cholesterol and heart disease, which we turned into a free ebook, which you can download from chriskresser.com if you haven't already done that. And definitely check that out. And then one of the earliest digital programs that I put together was one called the High Cholesterol Action Plan. And if you Google High Cholesterol Action Plan, you'll find it. We can also put a link in the show notes. But this is a course that goes into much, much more detail than the ebook does, because I got so many questions about this topic over the years, especially as I was writing about it early on. I just wanted to have a resource that I could direct people to that went into a lot more detail and provided a lot more assistance than I could ever do in a blog post or an ebook. So if you haven't checked all that stuff out, I would definitely do that. In this show, I'm going to just provide an overview of what I think the key factors are to be thinking about with this particular question. So the first factor is to understand that a functional approach to dyslipidemia or high cholesterol and even familial hypercholesterolemia is really different than the conventional approach. And for those listeners who aren't aware with familial hypercholesterolemia, or FH as we're going to call it, so I don't have to say that every time, FH is a disease that is, I don't like the term disease, but that's what it's referred to as. It's a condition that is genetically mediated. So there are genetic mutations involved that lead to very high cholesterol levels, often higher than 300 milligrams per deciliter. Believe it or not, it's not that easy to test for. Some of the genetic testing that you have to do to completely be certain that you have it is very expensive and not widely available. So in many cases, doctors will just, there are certain criteria called the Simon Broom criteria that can be used to get a more accurate indication of whether FH is likely to be present. But I've seen that many clinicians in practice will just, if they see a total cholesterol above 300, they'll often just diagnose the patient with FH on that basis alone, which is not a particularly accurate way of doing it, but there's certainly an argument to be made that FH is likely if total cholesterol is north of 300 milligrams per deciliter. Anyways, back to the factors here. As I said, the first factor to consider is that the functional approach to dealing with this issue is very different than the conventional approach, because in functional medicine, we view high cholesterol not as a disease, but as a symptom. And what's it a symptom of? Well, there are at least six key underlying processes that can lead to hypercholesterolemia. One is metabolic dysfunction. Another is chronic infections like H. pylori or even latent viral infections. Another is gut dysbiosis, permeability. That's number three. Number four is poor thyroid function. And this doesn't have to be frank hypothyroidism. It can even be subclinical hypothyroidism, where the thyroid is just, it's not, you know, completely shot, but it's just under functioning. It's not functioning optimally. And in fact, back in the 80s and prior to that, before statins really came onto the scene in a big way, doctors used to use low doses of thyroid hormone to treat high cholesterol, even when the patient had relatively normal thyroid numbers. The fifth cause is environmental toxins, especially heavy metals. And then the sixth cause would be genetic. There are, of course, others, but those are the six main ones that we look for in functional medicine. And we explore all of these causes to determine and address whatever the underlying or root pathology is. Because if you treat the root, that will often fix the branch. If you think of the disease process as like a tree, the roots are those core pathologies or underlying mechanisms that lead to the symptoms, which in this analogy are the branches. So you know, you can mess around with the branches and try to deal with things on that level, which is the conventional approach, or you can try to address the roots of the problem, which is what we're doing in functional medicine. In the conventional paradigm, it's really a lot more about symptom suppression. So if you have high cholesterol, you take a drug to lower it, statin drug in this case. If you have high blood pressure, you take a drug to lower that. And it's the same for many other conditions. In your case, Tyler, you mentioned that you have FH, which means we know you have at least one of those six underlying factors present, the genetic predisposition. But that doesn't mean that other factors aren't also playing a role. And in fact, I see this very often in my practice where I'll have a patient come in and they already know that they have FH, but when we do a full comprehensive workup, we find that they also have poor thyroid function and, you know, SIBO and gut dysbiosis and maybe a latent chronic infection and heavy metal toxicity. And all of those things are exacerbating the genetic predisposition to high cholesterol. The second factor to consider is that conventional lipid markers, which are the ones that we typically have tested for if you go to your doctor for routine blood work. So I'm talking about total cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, and HDL cholesterol, are not accurate predictors of cardiovascular disease risk. We know now, the most recent research has shown that these markers, total and LDL cholesterol, are not strongly associated with heart disease. The ratio of total to HDL cholesterol, as well as non-HDL cholesterol, which is similar, are better predictors than total cholesterol or LDL cholesterol, but they're nowhere near as predictive as some of the newer markers like LDL particle number, which in turn itself isn't as predictive as lipoprotein little a or LP little a. So these markers they tell us something different than the standard lipid markers. The standard lipid markers tell us how much cholesterol is inside of the lipoproteins. So if we use an analogy in your bloodstream, it's like a highway, the passengers inside of the car are equivalent to cholesterol inside of the lipoproteins, whereas the cars themselves would be equivalent to the lipoproteins. And extending this analogy, if you have a lot of cars on the road, there's a much greater likelihood that they'll get into an accident, they'll veer off the road and slam into the side of the road. And the side of the road here would be the fragile lining of the artery, the endothelium. So if you have a lot of LDL particles, which is reflected in the LDL particle number measurement, then because atherosclerosis is a gradient-driven process, there's a much greater likelihood that one of these LDL particles is going to damage the fragile endothelium and initiate the process of plaque formation. With lipoprotein little a, we know this is a different type of lipoprotein. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here because it gets pretty geeky, but it's known as one of the most atherogenic lipoproteins that have been identified. And it's the single most significant risk marker, lipid risk marker for heart disease. So of all of the things that we could measure in terms of lipid markers, lipoprotein little a, or capital L, small p, and then a small a in parentheses, is the most predictive for future risk of heart disease. So the point of this second factor is that what we measure is important. Usually doctors are only measuring total and LDL cholesterol, but what we really should be measuring as clinicians are things like LDL particle number, HDL particle number, lipoprotein little a. These give us a much better idea of overall risk. Third factor is that lipid markers, even the good ones, are only one part of the puzzle when it comes to quantifying overall risk. So we need to look at things like family history, inflammatory markers like C-reactive protein and fibrinogen and LPPLA2 and oxidized LDL, metabolic markers, so things like fasting insulin and fasting glucose, fasting leptin, post-meal blood sugar, hemoglobin A1C, and a variety of other markers that tell us what's happening with metabolic function. Other risk factors like hypertension and cigarette smoking. Hypertension and smoking are two of the strongest risk factors for heart disease, hands down. So those, of course, should always be looked at. Diet, lifestyle, stress, nutritional status, you know, either not enough of nutrient like vitamin D, for example, or too much of a nutrient like iron can increase the risk of heart disease. Status of the gut microbiota, there's increasing amount of research that shows that this plays a significant role in heart disease pathogenesis. And there are certain calculators out there that are available for free online that use at least a small number of these risk factors. The Reynolds risk score, for example, uses C-reactive protein and systolic blood pressure in addition to age and total cholesterol and HDL cholesterol and family history to determine the 10-year risk of heart disease expressed as a percentage. So, you know, you enter all of your information in and it turns back a percentage of, you know, what percent of the risk you have for having a heart attack in the next 10 years based on all these validated criteria. So you want the lowest it could be is 1%, and then it goes up from there. And you can put different numbers in there and play around and see what has the biggest impact on risk. And you'll see that it's not total cholesterol or even HDL cholesterol, but age actually is the biggest risk factor for heart disease. And you see that changing age around has the biggest impact on that risk prediction. So then there are other types of testing that look for objective evidence of plaque accumulation, like a calcium score and CIMT. And You know, these are tests that a doctor can do if they're warranted, and they provide a different angle. You know, the lipid markers are just looking at blood markers that are typically associated with heart disease, but a calcium score and a carotid intima media thickness test can tell you what's actually happening in terms of plaque accumulation. So those are the three factors to consider. And here's how I would approach someone with FH. I've had many patients with FH, so this is what I actually do. I start with the more advanced testing to determine what their LDL particle number, lipoprotein little a, and other important markers are, like fasting insulin, fasting post-meal glucose, and inflammatory markers, et cetera. And then I do a thorough history and get a thorough family history as well. We do then an entire functional medicine workup to determine if they have other contributing factors like SIBO or dysbiosis or infections, heavy metal toxicity, hypothyroidism, et cetera. And then we address all of those factors that we discover in that extensive workup. And then we retest all of these markers. And if they are then normal, great, our work is finished. If the markers are still elevated, we'll move on to a more detailed risk quantification. We may refer them out for calcium score or CIMT, and we may look at some of the other risk factors, lifestyle, stress, et cetera. And then if we deem that the risk is still significant, we'll try more advanced diet modification strategies. So we might, if they're a hyper responder to saturated fat and that increases their LDL particle number, we might put them on more of what I call a Mediterranean paleo approach, which is paleo that's lower in fat and higher in paleo-friendly carbohydrates, you know, whole food carbohydrates like starchy plants and even whole fruits and non-starchy vegetables. And then we'll emphasize monounsaturated fat more than saturated fat. Then we might use some supplements that have been shown to reduce LDL particle number and address inflammatory processes like delta and gamma tocotrienols, pantothene, curcumin, et cetera. And these will often lead to significant reduction in these various biomarkers that are risk factors for heart disease, even lipoprotein little a, which is in the conventional paradigm thought to be almost entirely genetically mediated and not really amenable to diet and lifestyle change, and furthermore is not typically affected by statins. If the numbers are still high after all of that, which is a lot, you know, that process takes typically several months, if not longer, because of all of the testing and all of the dietary intervention and the retesting and, you know, exploring and investigating all of those various underlying causes. Then if the numbers are still high and the patient is in a very high risk group, only then would I, you know, especially if it were me, consider statins and other medications. Statins are not effective, as I mentioned, for reducing lipoprotein little a in many patients. And so if that's the primary marker that's still elevated after all of this workup and treatment, those patients may need new drugs called antisense nucleotides or ASOs that specifically target lipoprotein little a. So that's just one example of how even the pharmaceutical aspect of the treatment, if it's determined that it's needed, can be more individually tailored based on the patient's unique circumstances and based on the most recent evidence, rather than just using a one-size-fits-all black and white approach, which is the typical way that it's done in the conventional paradigm. So Tyler, I realize this may have raised more questions than it answered, perhaps. And, you know, unfortunately, that's what happens when you dig into some of these topics. And this is, as I said at the outset of the show, certainly one of the most complex and nuanced areas of medicine and treatment. There are so many different things to consider. And I think the big public health campaign during the latter part of the 20th century was oriented around making this message as simple as possible so that people would comply with the diet and lifestyle recommendations that were being made. So this really oversimplified message of, oh, cholesterol is bad, and if you have high cholesterol, you need to bring it down and you should take a statin to do that is really out of date and not in sync with the most recent scientific evidence. And the lipidologists, the folks out there like Dr. Tom Dayspring and others are, you know, way, way ahead of how they approach cardiovascular disease and have been for many, many years, but that has not trickled down into the, you know, mainstream understanding and lexicon and to the average primary care doctor's office. The training is really for primary care doctors is really out of date. And unless, you know, someone is really taking the initiative to stay on top of all this stuff, or if they're lipidologists themselves, even a lot of cardiologists are not current with this information. And so it's a problem for patients who are trying to get help, because it's really difficult to do that from your local doctor unless they're really staying abreast of all of these more recent developments. So at least this podcast can give you some food for thought and you know, places to look for further information, discussion with your practitioner. We'll put some links to all of the resources that I mentioned here in the show notes. And for everybody else, keep sending in your questions. Tyler, thanks again for sending your question in. And that's it for today. I'll see you next time. Take care, everybody.
That's the end of this episode of Revolution Health Radio. If you appreciate the show and want to help me create a healthier and happier world, please head over to iTunes and leave us a review. They really do make a difference. If you'd like to ask a question for me to answer on a future episode, you can do that at chriskresser.com/podcastquestion. You can also leave a suggestion for someone you'd like me to interview there. If you're on social media, you can follow me at twitter.com/chriskresser or facebook.com/chriskresserlac. I post a lot of articles and research that I do throughout the week there that never makes it to the blog or podcast, so it's a great way to stay abreast of the latest developments. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you next time.